Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM. It's time now for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Delmarva Public Radio has a new manager, Dana Whitehair, and in a moment we'll be speaking with him about the future of the station. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Later on in the program, we'll be speaking with Matthew Peters, who is director of the Chesapeake Multicultural Resource Center in Easton, where there's a growing Hispanic population. But first, we want to turn to our new manager, Dana Whitehair. He has been affiliated in the past with WXXI and Rochester, New York, which has a classical music format, as well as WSCI in Charleston, South Carolina, which also features classical music and news talk. Also spent 17 years at KUT, the public radio station at the University of Texas in Austin. And welcome to not only the program, but the station.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask you this. In terms of coming up here, what's your overall impression, by the way, of Delmarva? And how does it contrast with, say, from where you've been?
Well, as you can see, the contrast just between where I've been from place to place has been pretty extreme. So I'm well versed at adjusting to almost anything at this point. But being back on the East Coast and being back near the ocean is something that I had looked forward to for quite a while. So, each culture is different, and each city that I've worked in has been different, and the needs are different. So I adjust pretty well.
Okay. Tell us then a little bit about your background. I mean, I went through some of the stations, but give me a sense about where you've been and the kinds of things that you've been worked on.
Sure. I got into public radio mostly from a music background. I came from a very musical family, and I didn't have the talent to be a musician, so I ended up being a recording engineer. And one of the greatest outlets for a recording engineer at that time was National Public Radio. So I started in 1981 with WXXI in Rochester, got to work with the Eastman School of Music, and Rochester is a huge, huge classical chamber music, choral, organ music, the whole nine yards up there. And that was also the first station where I realized that having a bit of an eclectic look, even though they were primarily a classical music, they played a lot of other styles of music as well. Same thing with South Carolina Educational Radio. While we focused in a major way on classical music with the Spoleto Festival there and numerous orchestras that we worked with, we also worked with jazz, reggae, folk, you name it. It was on the air, and they had a very open mind in terms of programming. That when I got to Austin, since it is the live music capital of the world, I worked with every conceivable kind of music at KUT, and some that defy explanation. So that really pounded it into my mind that public radio is a resource for many, many genres of music, not just classical music, and to be able to present many different kinds of music and many different genres and connect them all together. That's the other important thing, is to show that there's a thread between all these genres of music, and of course the news and information component as well, which anybody who's associated with NPR knows that's what's expected. But being able to present those in a way that is engaging, that is thoughtful, that's respectful to its audience, and mind expanding, I guess you could say, is what I think public radio does best, and I think that's what DPR has in its future.
Now, as a matter of fact, we were talking before we went on the show about KUT and Latino USA.
Yeah.
And I know we've done a number of stories about the growing Hispanic population here, both particularly in Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that experience. How did they get off the ground, and what were the dynamics there?
That was quite an undertaking. That idea was generated at the University of Texas at Austin with CMAS, which was the Center for Mexican American Studies. And they partnered with KUT and NPR to put that together. And it was a very grassroots effort. But the resulting program, in my opinion, is one of the most unique and powerful programs that NPR and NPR News and NPR News stations have come up with in quite a few years. And it addressed a need that I think was inadequately being addressed. both in Texas and nationally. So I think that program serves a wonderful need, and I'm glad to know that the program, you know, doesn't just, you know, still exist, but it's still a very powerful force within the NPR network.
So how do you see this radio station connecting with the community? I mean, obviously, we go on the air every morning and every day. Mm-hmm. We certainly communicate in that terms. But what kind of outreach do you see happening with the station in this community?
I've told people from the very beginning that my first job here is to listen. And I also said during the numerous interviews that I had that it is that connection with the community that is going to make DPR flourish and help us regain our position and regain our momentum. So I have to do an awful lot of listening. I have to ask a lot of questions. But I think that the DPR is on the right track in terms of, well, let me put it this way. If we learned anything from the process that we just went through in terms of asking the questions about DPR's future, you know, its role within the community, its role within the university community. I think a lot of answers just came out of that debate. And there's a wealth of information right there that I think DPR and the university and the foundation and the community as a whole can put to use. And that's going to be a resource as well. So I think what I said earlier about a very eclectic and open-minded approach to public radio, I think, is important in how we approach the future of DPR as well.
Because I know, as a matter of fact, during the last year, obviously, we've had a lot of supporters, including a group I guess called the Friends of DPR.
Yep.
How do you see the station relating to groups like that certainly coalesced during the last year, but beyond just simply the efforts to save the station and so on and support it, that are out there in the community?
I think they're a very important part. It's unfortunate that an organization like that had to develop as a result of some controversy and what was perceived as a threat to the future of DPR. Nonetheless, from the standpoint of it being a resource for the future of DPR, I do see that as a resource. I see them as, if you have a friends organization, that is a plus in my mind. And engaging the friends organizations and finding a role for them where everybody wins, that's going to be a challenge for me as well as DPR and as well as the university and the foundation and the friends organizations, because my understanding is there are two. They've both mm-hmm. contacted me, and I look forward to reaching out and speaking with them and, again, doing a lot of listening. But I think they have a role in DPR's future, and I think the process that we're going through right now, everybody is kind of figuring out what their new role is, including me. So I'll be learning along with everybody else.
And how do you see the relationship between the radio station and the university? And from what you know, from the way it's related into the past as well as going into the future?
I have many, 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 many years of experience working with public radio stations that are associated directly with either state agencies or state educational institutions. Of course, with the University of Texas at Austin, with Isothermal Community College in Western North Carolina, South Carolina Educational Radio, WSCI in Charleston, that was part of a statewide network that was focused on educational radio at the time, still is. So I have quite a bit of experience in terms of how the public radio station fits within those roles and within those organizations. And I'm intrigued by what we're going through, because the university taking on the licenses of DPR from the Salisbury University Foundation, they'll be learning as well. So this is kind of we'll be learning and growing together. And I think the role that DPR will play will develop as time goes on, but I see it at this point as being an outreach for the university to the community, and also a kind of a window for the community to engage with Salisbury University as well. So this is win-win as far as I'm concerned, and I think both entities can provide an awful lot of support and outreach and opportunities for one another, and that, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the most important resources that DPR will have in the future.
I was curious about, and I know you've just only gotten here, but what kind of role do you see students playing in all of this? Because, I mean, the number of students who will either hear this interview or people will be talking about, what's their role? What do you see? How are they interfacing this?
They have an advocate in me because I am a product of that very role. I started as a student intern, a student volunteer, actually, and then ended up being a student staff at WOUB in Athens, Ohio, at Ohio University. That's where I got into public radio first. So I understand that the value of working at a public radio station on a campus, especially one with the kind of track record and professionalism that DPR has, is extremely valuable. And I look back on the experience that I had, and I don't think I ever would have gotten as far as I did in public radio had I not gone through that process and the valuable experience that I had and the people I met and the networking opportunities that I had, it opened up a wonderful experience to me. If we can produce that same kind of opportunity for students at Salisbury University, I'm all for it.
So what do you see as the challenges for Delmarva Public Radio?
I think taking what the station and the foundation, university, and the public just went through and applying that to rebuilding the future of DPR. There are financial challenges. There are programming challenges. There are the challenges of the new relationships developing between DPR and the university and reestablishing connections with the community and finding out what the community needs are, ascertaining how DPR can serve those needs, and also generating both membership support and business support and foundation support and just trying to find how many resources we can find which can grow the sustainability of DPR in the future. That is probably the greatest challenge I have. And the programming that we have right now obviously needs to be looked at, needs to be evaluated. We have an opportunity coming up here very shortly. We have an opportunity to make some decisions on our NPR programming package. The university will be involved with that, DPR staff. By the way, I've been very, very impressed with the staff here, and I look forward to working with everybody here in this building as well. And so the programming is the key. That's like our product. So it has to be high quality. It has to be pertinent. It has to be important to the people to whom we turn and ask for support. And that's a lot of stakeholders that we're trying to include, and we're trying to build that. So we have to look at the programming and make sure that it's right for what DPR is doing right now, right for what I refer to as the Republic of Delmarva, and also right for the university as well. So it's finding that balance, and that's part of the challenge that I'm facing right now and part of the challenge that all the stakeholders are facing.
How do you address the need that many people feel that for more local programming, especially when you have a situation where it's not like somebody's going to drop, a largesse into our pockets? How do you work that so that you can get more local programming without necessarily incurring lots of expense?
Local programming has been extremely important to every station at which I've worked. That is the connection. I mean, if you just have NPR programming all the time or PRI programming or American Public Media programming, that's not creating a real live connection with the community. So local programming is very important to the mix that we're trying to put together. Without that, it's really not a public radio station. It's just an outlet for national programming or world programming if you include BBC into that. But that's the important connection. I've not necessarily dismissed the fact that somebody is going to drop a lot of money on us to allow us to do that. I never dismiss that. But I do think that developing the resources that we have, and there are some very unique cultural and arts resources both on campus and off campus here in the Republic of Delmarva, and I'm looking forward to putting them to use and showcasing them on DPR.
How do you see the competition? We've had lots of discussion on the peninsula, WAMU, just to name one. WDDE now has been developed, obviously, in Dover. Lots of public radio stations on the shore right now that, quite frankly, didn't exist at all when the station was first created. Matter of fact, it was sort of the lone outlet for public radio just in general. How do you deal with that competition?
It's a challenge that I've faced before. In North Carolina, we were surrounded by other public radio stations. The key that we had there, and the key that I think is going to be important for the future of DPR, is do something different. Don't program the exact same thing that they're programming. Look at everybody's programming that is available. If it's programming that is critical, that is going to be on several stations, then you try to adjust it and make it either adjust the time of where it is or adjust the content of where it is, so that of what's within the programming, so that you're providing something different. I use this quote many times during my interview process. As my great-grandfather used to say, the best way to play baseball is hit them where they ain't. And what DPR has to do, to a certain extent, is hit them where they ain't. We have to provide programming and services and programming content, local programming content, that other stations cannot provide. And that's one of the advantages I think DPR has, is we are here on Delmarva, and we do Delmarva, as far as I'm concerned, better than anybody else. There are certain things the other stations cannot do that we can do, and those are the strengths that we need to, you know, really put into our programming decisions.
We've been speaking with Dana Whitehair. He is the new general manager for Delmarva Public Radio, and I guess welcome aboard. And
thank you.
We look forward to talking to you in the future. Next, we are going to turn to Easton and Matthew Peters, who's director of the Chesapeake Multicultural Resource Center, and we'll be back in just a moment. We now turn to Easton, where there's a growing immigrant population, and Matthew Peters, who is the director of the Chesapeake Multicultural Resource Center, which has opened its doors to children in the area for after-school activities and community support. At first, Matthew spent about 13 years, I believe it was, in Guatemala, and is often called by his friends and students, Mateo. But first, I want to talk about your experience in Guatemala, because there are a lot of Guatemalans actually on the peninsula. As we've talked to, particularly a lot of undocumented, as I've talked to, particularly in Delaware and so on. And just it's a country that obviously has been dominated by right-wing military dictatorships. Probably the most emphasis was the former general and de facto ruler, President Efrén Ríos Montt, who recently was found guilty of crimes against humanity by a three-judge panel, although apparently that was overturned, and by the Guatemalan Constitutional Court. What appears to be, from what I can see, is some kind of jurisdictional dispute, but we'll figure that one out. So before we get into the Delmarva Peninsula here, tell us a little bit about your experience there and the kinds of people that you met that ultimately, you know, when you come up here, you see the same kinds of people.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on your program today. So I started my journey in Guatemala. This is back in 1999 as a Peace Corps volunteer, which is a great opportunity for a lot of young Americans and any aged Americans to get out into the underdeveloped world, to experience it, to learn about it, and hopefully, like what I'm doing today, to start coming up with solutions on what we can do for these countries. So this is back in 1999, a Peace Corps for 2-year program. I was lucky enough to be sent to a very rural part of Guatemala, a place that still had very few roads. I was only able to get in there by plane. And I specifically targeted this area because my background's in forestry, and I really wanted to focus on the rainforest of Guatemala. So I was very fortunate. It was a very unique experience I had in Peace Corps down there for 2 years. And during those 2 years, I guess my vision for coming back to the United States and working for the Forest Service really disappeared. I saw a lot of need down there. I started to see the destruction of the rainforest coming up into this region. Had a very good handle on how to solve some of the problems, such as reforestation. I got to know a lot of the species, not many of the people mm-hmm. yet. but the species, and decided I had enough confidence with my knowledge of the ecology down there to start a volunteer program. So in 2002, I started my own organization called Volunteer Pretend, which was like Peace Corps in a sense, where it invited international volunteers to come down and help me primarily work with reforestation projects, forest management, ecological restoration, and the such. It was rough starting, but it was very easy to live in where I was. You know, I think I lived on about $300 a year almost type of budget, just eating beans and rice and just planting trees. But little by little, we were able to get our 501c3. And by 2005, we started seeing, you know, about 150 volunteers a year coming in through this program. And with that, that came through our support, so more money, more ways to get involved with the community. So with that, once I started getting involved more with the community, it became apparent that everyone was really focusing on education. What I didn't realize at the time was how quickly Guatemala was shifting from an agricultural-based society to a modern society. And it came like wildfire kind of all around me, this change, as more and more people either being forced to or just deciding to drop out of the agriculture and really put all their chips into this modern society, which, of course, you have to be educated to be a part of. So I saw a huge force around me, and with these resources that I did have, we started to put it all into education. So we started to build schools, we built a library, and my final 3 years down there, I actually ran an ecological resource center or an ecological program for high school students to train them in natural resource management. So we were able to set up a working farm. We had goats, we had rabbits, we had chickens. We did agriculture. I taught them forest management, how to harvest trees properly, how to use different types of resources. So I was doing the best I could to get to help their society go from an agricultural-based society to a modern society. But the education is so drastically low down there. They're struggling so much right now on adapting to a modern society. And if you're going to go to Guatemala right now, anywhere you go, any region, even the small town and what was rural and jungle, I mean, it is completely changed. You see Burger Kings there now, Pizza Huts, there's shopping centers everywhere. Even out on these ancient ruins out in the jungle, you know, people are talking on their cell phones. People are, you know, playing on the internet out there. So it really has become a modern world, and they're really struggling with how to make that change and adaptation without education.
Let me ask you, because I've mentioned about the political struggles, obviously, that Guatemala has gone through. What is the situation now like, or what has it been like? I guess we have a current president, Otto Perez Molina. He's a retired military officer, and I guess he took office, I guess, it was last January of last year. Okay. When I see retired military officer, I kind of wonder what's going on here. What's happening there in terms of—
During my time in Guatemala, I experienced, I believe, 4 different presidents down there, which also coincides with all a government, so 4 different kind of congressmen, 4 different mayors in my town. So I've seen a lot of change in there. When I got there, it was right after the war ended. There was a 36-year civil war. Everything, of course, looked very positive after a 36-year civil war. So everything looked on the up and up. People, you know, there was a very positive vibe, especially in my region. Things, we can get things put together and working. Of course, the rest of Guatemala historically struggling with corruption, which is heavily in the government, all levels of government. In our region, it was still very small, so the corruption really didn't amount to much. But as the development process went on, more and more roads, more and more infrastructure, the country was really opening up. Free trade acts. Now we're having much more in and out of American products, Chinese products. More and more changes were happening to the country. So it was around 2010, especially in my region, when we started seeing the influence of drug cartels, which everyone kind of knew was a post-war type of effect when you had so many people trained to be in the military or paramilitary or the resistance. What do you do with all those people that spend their lives dedicating to fighting in a modern society or in an agricultural society? So there was a large growth of organized crime in the country. And once that kind of organized crime from the old war and warriors teamed up with this, with the money and the drug cartels, things really have started to go very, very bad in parts of Guatemala and parts of Honduras and parts of Salvador.
How does this all affect then how people are drawn from, say, that country or from Central America in general, Latin America, to this country? I mean, I've talked to people who have talked everywhere, everything from some economic reason, i.e. that they just needed the work and there wasn't any there, to people who left because of violence from, say, a military regime or some of the militaries or even some of the drug cartels. I mean, there seems is what pulls people out to make that long journey to a country where obviously they do not know the language, are not here legally. I mean, that's pretty big obstacles.
So from my viewpoint of being in this small town for 13 years and seeing what was going on there, when I first got there, it was probably about maybe 5% of the families had someone living in the United States. And those people mainly were got up here because of the war. Back during the 80s, early 90s, when the war was especially intense, people were granted some type of amnesty to get away from being killed or being threatened. So there was some connection, which helped family members maybe get out if they had tough times to be able to connect with families up here in the United States that were here legally because of their amnesty that they got during the war. Now, when I was there 2001 to 2004, I saw a huge spike of young men coming up to the United States because of the construction boom. They all came back and were sending lots of money down. All of them, when I was able to communicate with them, talking about how easy it was to come and get good-paying construction jobs. But that kind of died off around 2005, or the recession, then it really died off. And then I didn't see another push of people crossing until the violence started to hit our region. And then people were fleeing. A lot of the people in my village especially were being threatened by these drug cartels to leave their land, to sell their land, to leave the region. So I think in many of their minds, Guatemala is such a small country, many left to Mexico, and then many did make that journey up to the United States. And then right now I think the push is with so little education, so little economic growth or sustainability. There's no jobs, and if you can get a job, minimum wage there is still about $8 a day. Where you're living in a modern society, that doesn't work. $8 a day in an agricultural society, sure, like it was 15 years ago, that's fine. But try living on $18 a day when your only options for food are McDonald's and Burger King and you have to get around and you have to have all these things to move ahead. So many of the young people are just facing these huge obstacles and odds in Guatemala and in Duno that they, even if they're getting $8 an hour here, that's much better than $8 a day. And it's the same society. So they're already adapted to shopping at McDonald's, to going to Walmart, to living in with these. So coming to the United States really right now isn't much of a culture shock. Just a survival way to live in a modern society.
So what kinds of moments do we have left? What kinds of problems then do they face when they get here?
So families that are coming, especially in Easton, and I've met a lot. The majority of the families that have come up in the past 5 years are from Guatemala. So I do have this cultural connection. I do understand their history. I understand where they're coming from. When you ask them across the board, what is the one thing you want and need? It's pretty universal, if not 100% universal. We want education for our children. They know how hard it is to adapt to a modern society because they don't have the educational tools. Their children have to have that educational tool. So that's what we're focused on. The biggest need is making sure that their children are getting the educational tools they need. But then on the flip side of that, we know that that's not possible unless the parents get involved with education. We can't just focus on the children. We have to focus on the parents as well in order for their children to be ready for this modern society.
And finally, we have obviously this discussion about the possibility of immigration reform. We don't know what particular form it'll take. Senate's passed its version. House, we're not sure where that's going. How important is that reform, even in a Senate version, to these people? Because, I mean, getting, for instance, citizenship, even on the Senate bill, takes a long time.
Yeah.
Do they say they want citizenship?
The more, as I'm trying to understand, I thought of a whole bunch of stereotypes. When I met a whole bunch of women and they had, you know, lots of children, I honestly first thought, oh, it's anchor babies. Mm-hmm. When I saw so many young people coming up now, I thought, oh, it's because the Obama administration is going to be giving free, you know, permission to young people. But the more I investigate and get to know these families, no, they're not thinking. They're not strategizing on how to get these things. They are still at survival mode. So even when you talk about immigration reform, they're not. They're just trying to live that day. They're not strategizing or trying, you know, to think of a plan on becoming a citizen. They just want to live through that day. So this is a reality, and we have to, whether we have immigration reform or not, our communities have to develop ways to keep these people safe, productive, and, of course, educated. If we don't get them educated, there's really no chance for any solution.
We've been speaking with Matthew Peters. He is the director of the Chesapeake Multicultural Resource Center in Easton, which has opened up its doors to children in the area for after-school activities and community support. And we appreciate you stopping by and talking with us.
Thank you very much.
This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Del Marva Today is a production of Del Marva Public Radio. Don Rush is the host. Chris Rank is the executive producer and audio engineer. You can listen to this program again on our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. You can also view our program on PAC-14 television and on demand. Visit PAC-14.org for full details and schedules.